From PRI, Public Radio International.
Abuelo, she hisses, grinding stone against stone until it makes his teeth ache. Hang up your spikes, abuelo. But he doesn't. He can't. He won't. He's no grandpa with hair the color of cigarette stains and a blanket over his knees. He's no toothless old gasser sunning himself in the park. He's a big leaguer. Proud wearer of the Dodger blue. Wielder of stick and glove. How can he get old? The grass is always green. The light's always shining. No clocks or periods or halves or quarters. No punch in and punch out. This is the game that never ends.
That's the eminent Broadway director Jerry Zaks reading from what I think is the funniest baseball story ever written, T. Karagason Boyle's The Hector Quesadilla Story, one of the offerings on this very special Baseball Stories program of Selected Shorts, a celebration of the short story, a program that will also include some fine baseball poetry and some baseball talk with Bill Littlefield. Selected Shorts originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. As a kind of, pre-game warm-up, we thought you literary baseball lovers would enjoy hearing a few very brief selections from a most remarkable volume of poetry entitled Baseball Haiku. Some of the haiku are in Japanese, and we can well imagine that New York Yankees outfielder Hideki Matsui is murmuring them as he patrols his beat in the outfield of the stadium. But we're only going to give you some English language haiku, each perfect miniature capturing a fleeting but vivid moment in the life that surrounds the playing of the game. Now, these haiku were created by the collection's co-editor Cor Vandenhoevel, by Jack Kerouac, who, by the way, created the very first American haiku, by Bud Goodrich, Rafael de Grutola, by a writer with the charming pen name of Arizona Zipper, George Swede, Edward J. Reilly, Michael Fessler, and Gerard John Conforti. So we invited one of our regular Selected Shorts cleanup hitters, Alec Baldwin, who's here in the studio with me, to read a few of these. This may be a very new experience for most listeners and fans. Here they are, Baseball Haiku.
Squeeze play. The umpire whisk-brooming home plate.
Home run trot. The batter's eye a tape measuring the distance.
Empty baseball field. A robin hops along the bench.
A spring breeze flutters the notice for baseball tryouts.
Geese flying north, the pitcher stops his windup to watch.
Through the blue sky, the tape-wrapped baseball trails a black streamer.
Downpour. Windswept spray blows across the outfield.
Dispute at second base. The catcher lets some dirt run through his fingers.
Under the lights, hitting it out of the park and into the night.
Perfect game. End of seven. In the dugout, the pitcher sits alone.
Conference on the mound. The pitcher looks down at the ball in his hand.
Cold day. The traded catcher's empty locker.
The catcher cocks his arm halfway to third. The runner hesitates.
Bottom of the ninth, in the dugout, a row of bent heads.
Lost in the lights, the high fly ball that never comes down.
The boy, not chosen, steps over home plate, picks up his books.
Empty baseball field. A dandelion seed floats through the strike zone.
With a full count, the batter misses a hard fastball, dust from the catcher's glove.
Change of pitchers. The right fielder puts his glove over his face.
Biking to the field, under a cloudless sky, my glove on the handlebars. Baseball Haiku, Alec Baldwin, and yours truly, Isaiah Sheffer. You haiku fans will surely have noticed that what I've just said is itself a 17-syllable haiku. Moving right along to our first story, we'll hear Jerry Zaks, whose Broadway staging credits include the musicals Guys and Dolls and Anything Goes, as he reads T. Karagason Boyle's epic baseball story, in which absolutely anything goes in the dugout and on the field, and in which the game ain't over till it's over, and maybe not even then. Here it is, the Hector Quesadilla story.
He was no Jolton Joe, no Sultan of Swat, no Iron Man. For one thing, his feet hurt. And God knows no legendary immortal ever suffered so prosaic a complaint. He had shin splints, too, and corns and ingrown toenails and hemorrhoids. Demons drove burning spikes into his tailbone each time he bent to loosen his shoelaces. His limbs were skewed so awkwardly that his elbows and knees might have been transposed. And the once proud knot of his frijole-fed belly had fallen like an avalanche. Worse, he was old. Old, old, old. The graybeard hobbling down the rough-hewn steps of the Senate building. The Ancient Mariner chewing on his whiskers and stumbling in his socks. Though they listed his birth date as 1942 in the program, there were those who knew better. It was way back in 54, during his rookie year for San Buitre, that he had taken Asuncion to the altar. And even in those distant days, even in Mexico, 12-year-olds didn't marry. When he was younger, really young, 19, 20, tearing up the Mexican League like a saint of the stick, his ears were so sensitive he could hear the soft, rasping friction of the pitcher's fingers as he massaged the ball and dug in for a slider, fastball, or changeup. Now he could barely hear the umpire bawling the count in his ear. And his legs, how they ached, how they groaned and creaked and chattered, how they'd gone to fat. He ate too much. That was the problem. Ate prodigiously, ate mightily, ate as if there were a hidden thing inside him, a creature all of jaws with an infinite trailing ribbon of gut. Huevos con chorizo with beans, tortillas, camarones in red sauce, and a 12-ounce steak for breakfast. The chicken and mole to steady him before afternoon games. A sea of beer to wash away the tension of the game and prepare his digestive machinery for the flaming machaca and pepper salad Asuncion prepared for him in the blessed evenings of the homestand. 5'7", 189 3/4 pounds. Hector Hernan Jesus y Maria Quesadilla. Little cheese, they called him. Cheese, cheese. Jesus went up the cry as he stepped in to pinch hit in some late inning crisis. Cheese, cheese, Jesus, building to a roar until Chavez Ravine resounded as if with the holy name of the Savior himself when he stroked one of the clean line drive singles that were his signature or laid down a bunt that stuck like a finger in jelly. When he fanned, when the bat went loose in the fat brown hands and he went down on one knee for support, they hissed and called him viejo. One more season, he tells himself, though he hasn't played regularly for nearly 10 years and can barely trot to first after drawing a walk. One more. He tells Asuncion, too, one more, as they sit in the gleaming kitchen of their house in Boyle Heights, he with his carta blanca, she with her mortar and pestle for grinding the golden petrified kernels of maize into flour for the tortillas he eats like peanuts. Una más, she mocks. What do you want, the Hall of Fame? Hang up your spikes, Hector. He stares off into space, his mother's Indian features flattening his own as if the legend were true, as if she really had taken a spatula to him in the cradle. And then, dropping his thick lids as he takes a long, slow swallow from the neck of the bottle, he says, just the other day, driving home from the park, I saw a car on the freeway, a Mercedes with only two seats. A girl in it, her hair out, back like a cloud. And you know what the license plate said? His eyes are open now, black as pitted olives. Do you? She doesn't. Cheese, he says. It said cheese. Then she reminds him that Hector Jr. will be 29 next month and that Reina has four children of her own and another on the way. You're a grandfather, Hector, almost a great-grandfather if your son ever settled down. A moment slides by, filled with the light of the sad, waning sun and the harsh Yucatano dialect of the radio announcer. Hombres on first and third, one down. Abuelo, she hisses, grinding stone against stone until it makes his teeth ache. Hang up your spikes, abuelo. But he doesn't. He can't. He won't. He's no grandpa with hair the color of cigarette stains and a blanket over his knees. He's no toothless old gasser sunning himself in the park. He's a big leaguer, proud wearer of the Dodger blue, wielder of stick and glove. How can he get old? The grass is always green, the light's always shining. No clocks or periods or halves or quarters, no punch in and punch out. This is the game that never ends. When the heavy hitters have fanned and the pitcher's arm's gone sore, when there's no joy in Mudville, taxes are killing everybody and the Russians are raising hell in Guatemala, when the manager paces the dugout like an attack dog, mind racing, searching high and low for the canny veteran to go in and do single compact, there he'll be. Always, always, eternal as a monument. Hector Quesadilla, utility infielder with a .296 lifetime batting average and service with the Reds, Phils, Cubs, Royals, and L.A. Dodgers. So he waits, hangs on, trots his aching legs round the outfield grass before the game, touches his toes 10 agonizing times each morning, takes extra batting practice with the rookies and slumping millionaires, sits, watches, massages his feet, waits through the scourging road trips in the Midwest and along the East Coast, down to muggy Atlanta, across to stormy Wrigley, and up to frigid Candlestick, his gut clenched round an indigestible cut of meatloaf and instant potatoes and wax beans, waits at the end of the bench for a word from the manager, for a pat on the ass, a roar, a hiss, a chorus of cheers and catcalls, the marimba pulse of bat striking ball and the sweet looping arc of the clean base hit. And then comes a day late in the season, the homeboys battling for the pennant with the big stick Braves and the sneaking gents, when he wakes from honeyed dreams in his own bed that's like an old friend with the sheets that smell of starch and soap and flowers and feels the pain stripped from his body as if at the touch of a healer's fingertips. Usually he dreams nothing, the night a blank, an erasure, and opens his eyes on the agonies of the martyr strapped to a bed of nails. Then he limps to the toilet, makes a poor, discolored water, rinses the dead taste from his mouth, and staggers to the kitchen table where food, only food, can revive in him the interest in drawing another breath. He butters tortillas and folds them into his mouth, spoons up egg and melted jack cheese and frijoles refritos with the green salsa, lashes into his steak as if it were cut from the thigh of Kerensky. Kerensky, the Atlanta relief ace who twice that season caught him looking at a full-count fastball with men in scoring position. But not today. Today's different. A sainted day, a day on which sunshine sits in the windows like a gift of the magi, and the chatter of the starlings and the crapped-over palms across the street is a thing that approaches the divine music of the spheres. Feliz cumpleaños, Asuncion pipes as he steps through the doorway. Her face is lit with the smile of her mother, her mother's mother, the line of gift-givers descendant to the happy conquistadors and joyous Aztecs. A kiss, a dulce, and then a knock at the door, and Reina, fat with life, throwing her arms around him while her children gobble up the table, the room, their grandfather, with eyes that swallow their faces. Happy birthday, Daddy, Reina says, and Franklin, her youngest, is handing him the gift. And Hector Jr.? Ah, but he doesn't have to fret about Hector Jr., his firstborn, the boy with these same great sad eyes who'd sat in the dugout in his Reds uniform when they lived in Cincy and worshipped the pudgy icon of his father until the parish priest had to straighten him out on his hagiography. Hector Jr., who studies English at USC and day and night writes his thesis on a poet his father has never heard of, because here he is, walking in the front door with his mother's smile and a store-wrapped gift, a book, of course. Then Reina's children line up to kiss the abuelo. They'll be sitting in the box seats this afternoon, and suddenly he knows so much. He will play today. He will hit. Oh, yes. Can there be a doubt? He sees it already. Kerensky, the son of a whore. Extra innings. Kerner or Manfredoni or Brooksy on third, the ball like an orange. A mango. A muskmelon, the clean swipe of the bat, the delirium of the crowd, and the gimpy abuelo, a big leaguer still, doffing his cap and taking a tour of the bases in a stately trot, sultan for a day. Could things ever be so simple? In the bottom of the ninth, with the score tied at 5 and Reina's kids full of Coke, hot dogs, peanuts, and ice cream and getting restless, with Asuncion clutching her rosary as if she were drowning, and Hector Jr.'s nose stuck in some book, Dupuy taps him to hit for the pitcher with 2 down and fast Freddie Phelan on second. The 8th man in the lineup, Spider Martinez from Muchas Vacas, Dominican Republic, has just whiffed on 3 straight pitches. And Corcoran, the Braves' left-handed relief man, is all of a sudden pouring it on. Throughout the stadium, a hush has fallen over the crowd. The torpor of summertime, the game poised at apogee. Shadows are lengthening in the outfield, swallows flitting across the face of the scoreboard. Here a fan drops into his beer. There a big mama gathers up her purse, her knitting, her shopping bags and parasol, and thinks of dinner. Hector sees it all. This is the moment of catharsis, the moment to take it out. As Martinez slumps toward the dugout, Dupuy, a laconic, embittered man who keeps his suffering inside and drinks Jellicle like water, takes hold of Hector's arm. His eyes are red-rimmed and paunchy, doleful as a basset hound's. "Bring the runner in, champ," he rasps. "First pitch, fake a bunt, then hit away. Watch Booger at third." "Uh-huh," Hector mumbles, snapping his gum. Then he slides his bat from the rack. White ash, tape-wrapped grip, personally blessed by the Archbishop of Guadalajara and his 27 acolytes. And starts for the dugout steps, knowing the course of the next 3 minutes as surely as his blood knows the course of his veins. The familiar cry will go up. "Cheese, cheese, cheese, ah!" And he'll amble up to the batter's box, knocking imaginary dirt from his spikes, adjusting the straps of his golf gloves, tugging at his underwear, and fiddling with his batting helmet. His face will be impenetrable. Corcoran will work the ball in his glove, maybe tip back his cap for a little hair grease, and then give him a look of psychopathic hatred. Hector's seen it before. Me against you. My record, my career, my house, my family, my life, my mutual funds and beer distributorship against yours. He's been hit in the elbow, the knee, the groin, the head. Nothing phases him, nothing. Murmuring a prayer to Santa Griselda, patroness of the sun-blasted Sonoran village where he was born like a heat blister on his mother's womb, Hector Hernan Jesus y Maria Quesadilla will step into the batter's box ready for anything. But it's a game of infinite surprises. Before Hector can set foot on the playing field, Corcoran suddenly doubles up in pain. Phelan goes slack at second, and the catcher and shortstop are hustling out to the mound, tailed an instant later by trainer and pitching coach. First thing Hector thinks is groin pull, then appendicitis, and finally, as Corcoran goes down on one knee, poison. Now, he'd once seen a man shot in the gut at Obregon City, but the report had been loud as a thunderclap, and he hears nothing now but the enveloping hum of the crowd. Corcoran is rising shakily, the trainer and pitching coach supporting him while the catcher kicks meditatively in the dirt. And now Mueller, the Atlanta cabeza, is striding big-bellied out of the dugout, head down as if to be sure his feet are following orders. Halfway to the mound, Mueller flicks his right hand across his ear, quick as a horse flicking its tail, and it's all she wrote for Corcoran. Poised on the dugout steps like a bird dog, Hector waits, his eyes riveted on the bullpen. "Please," he whispers, praying for the intercession of the Niño and pledging 100 votary candles, at least, can it be? "Yes, milk of my mother, yes." Kerensky himself strutting out onto the field like a fighting cock. Kerensky! Come to the birthday boy, Kerensky. He murmurs, so certain he's gonna put it in the stands he could point like the immeasurable Bambino. His tired old legs shuffle with impatience as Kerensky stalks across the field, and then he's turning to pick Asuncion out of the crowd. She's on her feet now. Reina, too. The kids come alive beside her. And Hector Jr., the book forgotten, his face transfigured with the look of rapture he used to get when he was a boy sitting on the steps of the dugout. Hector can't help himself. He grins, and he gives him the thumbs-up sign. Then, as Kerensky fires his warm-up smoke, the loudspeaker crackles, and Hector emerges from the shadow of the dugout into the tapering golden shaft of the late afternoon sun. "That pitch. Yeah, I want that one," he mutters, carrying his bat like a javelin and shooting a glare at Kerensky. But something's wrong here. The announcer's got it screwed up. "Batting for Raritan, number 39, Dave Toole." What the? And now somebody's tugging at his sleeve, and he's turning to gape with incomprehension at the freckle-faced bat boy. Dave Toole striding out of the dugout with his big 42-ounce stick. Dupuis's face locked up like a vault, and the crowd on its feet chanting, "Toole, Toole, Toole." For a moment, he just stands there, frozen with disbelief. Then Toole is brushing by him, and the idiot of a bat boy is leading him toward the dugout as if he were an old blind fisherman poised on the edge of the dock. He feels as if his legs have been cut out from under him. Toole? Dupuis is yanking him for Toole? For what? So he can play the lefty-righty percentages like some chess head or something? Toole, of all people. Toole, with his 35 home runs a season and lifetime batting average of .234. Toole, who's worn so many uniforms they had to expand the league to make room for him. What's he going to do? Raging, Hector flings down his bat, comes at Dupuis like a cat tossed in a bag. You crazy, you jerky, sputters. I would have hit him. I would have won the game. I dreamed it. And then his voice breaking, "It's my birthday, for Christ's sake." But Dupuis can't answer him because on the first pitch, Toole slams a real worm burner to short and the game is going into extra innings. By 7 o'clock, half the fans have given up and gone home. In the top of the 14th, when the visitors came up with a pair of runs on a two-out pinch-hit home run, there was a real exodus. But then the Dodgers struck back for two to knot it up again. Then it was three up and three down, regular as clockwork. Now at the end of the 19th, with the score deadlocked at 7-all and the players dragging themselves around the field like gut-shot horses, Hector is beginning to think he may get a second chance after all. Especially the way Dupuis's been using up players like some crazy general on the Western Front, yanking pitchers, juggling his defense, throwing in pinch runners and pinch hitters until he's just about gone through the entire roster. Asuncion is still there among the faithful, the foolish, and the self-deluded, fumbling with a rosary and mouthing prayers for Jesus Christ, our Lord, the Madonna, Hector, the home team, and her departed mother in that order. Reyna, too, looking like the survivor of some disaster. Franklin and Alfredo asleep in their seats. The Niñita's gone off somewhere for coke and dogs, maybe, and Hector Jr. looks like he's going to stick it out, too. Though he should be back in his closet writing about the mystical so-and-so and the way he illustrates his poems with gods and men and serpents. Watching him, Hector can feel his heart turn over. In the bottom of the 20th, with one down and Gilly on first, he's a starting pitcher, but Dupuis sent him in to run for Manfredonia after Manfredonia jammed his ankle like a turkey and had to be helped off the field. Hector pushes himself up from the bench and ambles down to where Dupuis sits in the corner, contemplatively spitting a gout of tobacco juice and saliva into the drain at his feet. Let me hit, Bernard. Come on, Hector says, easing down beside him. Can't, comes the reply, and Dupuis never even raises his head. Can't risk it, champ. Look around you. And here the manager's voice quavers with uncertainty, with fear and despair and the dull edge of hopelessness. I got nobody left. I hit you. I gotta play you. No, you don't understand. I'm gonna win it. I swear. And then the two of them, like old bankrupts on a bench in Miami Beach, look up to watch Phelan hit into a double play. A buzz runs through the crowd when the Dodgers take the field for the top of the 22nd. Though Phelan is limping, Thorkelson's asleep on his feet, and Dorfman, fresh on the mound, is the only pitcher left on the roster, the moment is electric. One more inning and they tie the record set by the Mets and Giants back in 64. And then they're making history. Drunk, sober, and then drunk again, saturated with fats and nitrates and sugar, the crowd begins to come to life. Go, Dodgers! Eat! Yo, mama! Phelan's a bum! Yeah, Hector can feel it too, the rage and frustration. The rage and frustration that had consumed him back in the ninth are gone, replaced by a dawning sense of wonder. He could have won it then, yes. And against his nemesis, Kerensky, too. But the Niño and Santa Griselda have been saving him for something greater. He sees it now, knows it in his bones. He's going to be the hero of the longest game in history. As if to bear him out, Dorfman, the kid from Albuquerque, puts in a good inning, cutting the bushed Braves down in order. Hector watches as Toole, who'd stayed in the game at first base, fans on three straight pitches. Then he shoves in beside Dorfman and tells the kid he's looking good out there. With his big Cornhuskers ears and nose like a tweezer, Dorfman could be a caricature of the green rookie. He says nothing. Hey, don't let it get to you, kid. I'm going to win this one for you. Next inning, or maybe the inning after. And then he tells him how he saw it in a vision, and how it's his birthday and the kid's going to get the victory, one of the biggest of all time. 24, 25 innings, maybe. Hector had heard of a game once in the Mexican League that took 3 days to play and went 73 innings. Did Dorfman know that? 73 innings. It was down in Culiacan. Yeah, Chito Maridi, the converted bullfighter, had finally ended it by dropping down dead of exhaustion in center field. Now, allowing Sextro Silvestro, who'd broken his leg rounding third, to crawl home with the winning run. But Hector doesn't think this game will go that long. Dorfman sighs and extracts a bit of wax from his ear as Pantaleo, the third-string catcher, hits back to the pitcher to end the inning. I hope not, he says, uncoiling himself from the bench. My arm would fall off. 10 o'clock comes and goes. Dorfman's still in there, throwing breaking stuff and a little smoke at the Braves, who look as if they just stepped out of the Night of the Living Dead. The home team isn't doing much better. Dupuis run through the whole team, but for Hector, and three or four of the guys have been in there since 2 p.m. The rest are a bunch of ginks and gimps who can barely stand up. Out in the stands, the fans look grim. The vendors ran out of beer an hour back, and they haven't had dogs or crowd or Coke or anything since 8:30. In the bottom of the 27th, Phelan goes berserk in the dugout, and Dupuis has to pin him to the floor while Doc Pucer shoves something up his nose to calm him. Next inning, the balls and strikes ump passes out cold. And Dorfman, who's beginning to look a little fagged, walks the first two batters, but manages to weasel his way out of the inning without giving up the go-ahead run. Meanwhile, Thorkelson has been dropping ice cubes down his trousers to keep awake. Martinez is smoking something suspicious in the can, and Ferenc Fortnoy, the third baseman, has begun talking to himself in a tortured Slovene dialect. For his part, Hector feels stronger and more alert as the game goes on. Though he hasn't had a bite since breakfast, he feels impervious to the pangs of hunger, as if he were preparing himself, mortifying his flesh like a saint in the desert. And then, in the top of the 31st, with half the fans asleep and the other half staring into nothingness, like the inmates of the asylum of Our Lady of Guadalupe, where Hector had once visited his half-wit uncle when he was a boy, Pluto Morales cracks one down the first base line and Tool flubs it. Right away, it looks like trouble because Chester Bubo is running around right field looking up at the sky like a bird watcher while the ball snakes through the grass, caroms off his left foot, and coasts like silk to the edge of the warning track. Morales, meanwhile, is rounding second and coming on for third, running in slow motion, flat-footed and humpbacked, his face drained of color, arms flapping like the undersized wing of some big, flightless bird. It's not even close. By the time Bubo can locate the ball, Morales is 10 feet from the plate, pitching into a face-first slide that's at least three parts collapse. And that's it. The Braves are up by one. It looks black for the home team, but Dorfman, though his arm has begun to swell like a sausage, shows some grit, bears down, and retires the side to end the historic top of the unprecedented 31st inning. Now, at long last, the hour has come. It'll be Bubo, Dorfman, and Tool for the Dodgers in their half of the inning, which means that Hector will hit for Dorfman. I've been saving you, champ, Dupuis rasps, the empty, jealous little bottle clenched in his fist like a hand grenade. Go on in there, he murmurs, and his voice fades away to nothing as Bubo pops the first pitch up in the back of the plate. Go on in there and do your stuff. Sucking in his gut, Hector strides out onto the brightly lit field like a 19-year-old. The familiar cry in his ears, the haggard fans on their feet. Asuncion looks as if she's been nailed to the cross. Reina wakes with a start and shakes the little ones into consciousness, and Hector Jr. staggers to his feet like a battered middleweight coming out for the 15th round. They're all watching him. The fans whose lives are like empty sacks, the wife who wants him home in front of the TV, his divorced daughter with the four kids and another one on the way, his son, pride of his life, who reads for the doctor of philosophy while his crazy padrecito puts on a pair of long stockings and chases around after a little white ball like a case of arrested development. He'll show them. He'll show them some cojones, some true grit and desire. The game's not over yet. on the mound for the Braves is Bo Brannerman, a big, mustachioed machine of a man, normally a starter, but pressed into desperate relief service tonight. A fine pitcher. Hector would be the first to admit it. But he just pitched two nights ago, and he's worn thin as wire. Hector steps up to the plate, feeling legendary. He glances over at Tool in the on-deck circle, and then down at Booger, the third-base coach. All systems go. He cuts at the air twice and then watches Brannerman rear back and release the ball. Strike one. Hector smiles. Why rush things? Give them a thrill. He watches a low outside slider that just about bounces to even the count and then stands like a statue as Brannerman slices the corner of the plate for strike two. From the stands, a chant of Viejo, Viejo, and Asuncion's piercing soprano, hit him, Hector! Hector has no worries. The moment eternal, replayed through games uncountable. With pitchers who were over the hill when he was a rookie with Sambuitre, with pups like Brannerman, with big leaguers and Hall of Famers. Here it comes, Hector, 92 miles per hour, the big gringo trying to throw it by you. The matchless wrists, the flawless swing, one terrific moment of suspended animation, and all of a sudden you're starring in your own movie. How does it go? The ball cutting through the night sky like a comet, arching high over the center fielder's hapless, scrambling form to slam off the wall while your legs churn up the base paths. You're round first in a gallop, taking second and heading for third. But wait, you spill hot coffee on your hand and you can't feel it. The demons apply the live wire to your tailbone. The legs give out, and they cut you down at third while the stadium erupts in howls of execration and abuse, and the niñitos break down, faces flooded with tears of humiliation. Hector Jr. turning his back in disgust, and Asuncion raging like a harpy. Abuelo, abuelo, abuelo! Stunned, shrunken, humiliated, you stagger back to the dugout in a maelstrom of abuse. Paper cups, flying spittle. Your life a waste, the game a cheat. And then, crowning irony, that bum, Tool, worthless all the way back to his washerwoman grandmother and the drunken, muttering, way-faced tribe that gave him suck, stands tall like a giant and sends the first pitch out of the park to tie it. Oh, the pain. Flat feet, fire in your legs, your poor, tired old heart skipping a beat in mortification. And now Dupuis, red in the face, shouting, the game could be over, but for you, you crazy, gimpy old beaner washout. You want to hide in your locker, bury yourself under the shower room floor, but you have to watch as the next two men reach base, and you pray with fervor that they'll score and put an end to your debasement. But no. Thorkelson whiffs, and the new inning dawns as inevitably as the new minute, the new hour, the new day, endless, implacable, world without end. But wait. Wait. Who's going to pitch? Dorfman's out. There's nobody left. The astonishing 32nd inning is marching across the scoreboard like an invading army. And suddenly, Dupuis is standing over you. No. He's down on one knee, begging. Hector, he's saying, didn't you used to pitch down in Mexico when you were a kid? Didn't I hear that someplace? Well, yes, you're saying yes, but that way, and then you're out on the mound. In command once again, elevated like some half-mad old king in a play, and throwing smoke. The first two batters go down on strikes, and the fans are rabid with excitement. Asuncion will raise a shrine. Hector Jr. worships you more than all the poets that ever lived. But can it be? You walk the next three and give up the grand slam to little Tommy Oshimisi. Mother of God, will it never cease? But wait. Here comes the bottom of the 32nd, and Brannerman's wild. He walks a couple, gets a couple out. Somebody reaches on an infield single, and the bases are loaded for you. The bases are loaded for you, Hector Quesadilla, stepping up to the plate now like the Iron Man himself. The windup, the delivery, the ball hanging there like a piñata, like a birthday gift, and then the stick flashes in your hands like an archangel's sword. And the game goes on forever.
It goes on and on, the Hector Quesadilla story by T. Caragas and Boyle, read by Jerry Zaks. Now, this reading can be found on the Selected Shorts baseball CD, which you can find at your local bookstore or at our website, www.selectedshorts.org. When we come back from our brief seventh-inning stretch, we'll hear about some real-life ballplayers from the early days of the game. You are listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts, recorded live at Symphony Space in New York City. Symphony Space's season is sponsored by Zabar's, offering the nation a taste of New York. Coffee, gourmet foods, and gift baskets available online at zabars.com. Now, we continue this special baseball edition of Selected Shorts with an excerpt from Lawrence S. Ritter's evocative book, which is about mostly forgotten old-timers who flourished in baseball's golden era. That was before the lively ball, instant replay, and stadium luxury seats. The book is called The Glory of Their Times, and the reader is John Rubinstein.
I was born in 1890 in Shamokin, Pennsylvania. That's anthracite country, about halfway between Scranton and Harrisburg. When I was 12 years old, I was working in the mines from 7 in the morning to 7 at night, 6 days a week. Which means a 72-hour week, if you care to figure it up. For those 72 hours, I got $3.75, about 5 cents an hour. There was nothing strange in those days about a 12-year-old Polish kid in the mines for 72 hours a week at a nickel an hour. What was strange was that I ever got out of there. Like I said, I never played much baseball in those days. I couldn't. Never saw the sunlight. Most of the year, I went to work in the dark and came home in the dark. I would have been a natural for night baseball. Never knew the sun came up any day but Sunday. But every evening after I got home, I'd throw stones at tin cans. I don't know why, just for something to do, I guess. Heck, we didn't have any television then, or radio, or automobiles, or even a telephone or electric lights. Had to do something, so I threw stones. I'd put a tin can on a log or tie it to a tree and stand maybe 40 or 50 feet away and throw stones at it. Did that every night till it was time to go to bed. I did that for so many years I could hit one of those things blindfolded. Well, a semi-pro team in town heard about me being so good throwing stones at tin cans, and they asked me if I'd like to pitch for them. That was in 1908 when I was 18. Of course, maybe being Harry's kid brother had something to do with it, too. And before I knew it hit me, I was signed to a contract with Lancaster, and I was out of those damn mines for good. Never forget leaving home for the first time to go play with Lancaster. It was the first time I ever rode on a train. Had to get a new suit of clothes to go off to the big city, but was too bashful to buy it. So Mom and Dad went to town, picked one out, brought it home to fit on me. Then when I got to Lancaster, I was too shy to eat in the hotel with the rest of the team. I'd go to a hot dog stand and eat by myself instead, pay for it out of my own pocket. After a couple of weeks, some of the players got suspicious, never seeing me around. So one day, they followed me and caught me eating my hot dogs. After that, they made me go to the hotel dining room with them. I'm glad they did. I pitched for Lancaster for a few years, then went up for a trial with the Athletics late in 1912 with Connie Mack. Connie was a good manager. He was a very considerate man. If you did something wrong, he'd never bawl you out on the bench or in the clubhouse. In the evening, he'd ask you to take a walk with him. And on the way, he'd tell you what you'd done wrong. One day, Connie called me in and told me I was to start that day. My first big league game. I was a little nervous, but not too much. Hell, I'd been around by then, 4 years in the Tri-State League. I figured I could do the job. Ben Egan caught me. Remember Big Benny? All you have to do is throw it right to me, Ben said. I'll give you a good target, just aim for my glove. So that's what I did. Pitched a three-hitter. I aimed at Big Benny's glove, and it was just like throwing stones at tin cans. I didn't know the batters hadn't been there long enough to learn their weaknesses. All I knew was to aim at his glove, but that was enough. I always had good control. I'm throwing those stones. You know, once with Cleveland later on, I pitched 7 full innings without throwing a single ball. Every pitch I threw was either a strike or was hit by the batter. Not one pitch in 7 innings that wasn't over the plate. I did okay in that trial with the Athletics. 1-2, lost 1. But I couldn't break into that pitching staff Connie had then. Chief Bender, Eddie Plank, Jack Combs, Herb Pennock. Don't know who could have beat them out. So Connie sent me back to the minors, out to the coast. Put in 2 years with Spokane, then 1 with Portland in the Pacific Coast League. And I guess that year with Portland, 1915, was the turning point. I was 25 years old, was in my 7th year in the minors, and was starting to wonder if I'd ever make it to the big leagues. I had good control, a good curve, a good fastball, and a good slow ball. But evidently, that wasn't enough. One day, I was watching one of the Portland pitchers throwing spitballs. By gosh, I said, I'm going to try to throw that. Started working on the spitter. Before long, I had that thing down pat. Never thrown it before in my life. But before that season was over, it was my main pitch. And the next year, I was up with the Cleveland Indians. That pitch, the spitball, kept me up there for 13 years and won me over 200 games. I got so good, I had such control over the spitball as I did over my other pitches. Could make it break any of 3 ways, down, out, or down and out. And I always knew which way it would break. Depending on my wrist action. For the spitball, what you do is wet these first 2 fingers. I used alum, had it in my mouth. Sometimes it would pucker your mouth some, get gummy. I'd go to my mouth on every pitch. Not every pitch would be a spitball. Sometimes I'd go maybe 2 or 3 innings without throwing one. But I'd always have them looking for it. They outlawed the spitter in December 1920. Said only certain established spitballers could continue to throw it after that. Me and 16 others was all. Maybe the great year I had in 1920 had something to do with it, I don't know. They wanted to shift the odds more in favor of the batter. Well, that's the way it is in baseball. I enjoyed playing ball, but it's a tough racket. There's always somebody sitting on the bench just itching to get in there in your place. Thinks he can do better. Wants your job in the worst way. Back to the coal mines for you, pal. The pressure never lets up. Doesn't matter what you did yesterday. That's history. It's tomorrow that counts. So you worry all the time. It never ends. Lord, baseball is a worrying thing.
John Rubenstein, reading from Lawrence S. Ritter's The Glory of Their Times. Before we close this baseball special with a great poem about the game, let's have a talk with the splendid Boston baseball writer Bill Littlefield, who's the host of NPR's Only a Game, and whose new book is also called Only a Game, published by the University of Nebraska Press. Bill Littlefield is on the line from WBUR in Boston. Hi, Bill.
How are you?
I'm very well. It's a bright August day here with the smell of the postseason in baseball just around the corner. It's beginning
Excellent.
To get a little cool. So I cannot imagine us doing a program like this one about football or basketball or golf. What is it, Bill, that makes baseball so attractive a subject for writers and poets?
Yeah, one of my theories is that there is so much downtime built into baseball. You know, you go to a baseball game and you sit down and there's time between batters, there's time between innings, and even if it's a game that isn't on television, it takes a certain amount of time. You know, you see something, you get an image, and you get a chance to kind of roll it over and think about it and talk about it with somebody else. And, of course, Roger Angel has written so brilliantly about the power of baseball images recollected in tranquility. And I don't think there are opportunities like that with our other games. And baseball appeals to lots of people for lots of different reasons. But I think stories is a big part of it. And, of course, baseball is very interested in numbers, and the numbers quantify virtually everything that a player mm-hmm. does. And so when people sit down to tell each other baseball stories, they can haul out their notebooks and say, look, you know, here is proof. His ERA was better than this other guy's ERA, and his on-base percentage, which is much more important than batting average. And they can get into all this sort of argument that isn't really likely to happen in the context of another game.
Bill, do you have a favorite piece of baseball writing or baseball fiction, just one that outshines the others in your mind?
Well, one that comes to mind right away is Bang the Drum Slowly and the rest of the baseball novels of Mark Harris. And this, of course, is because Mr. Harris passed away only fairly recently, mm-hmm. earlier this year. But his stuff was so good. And it's really a disservice to call Mark Harris's novels baseball novels, because that diminishes them. They were novels, and they are great stories, great novels full of rich characters. They happen to be set in baseball.
You know, in Symphony Space's political cabaret, The Thalia Follies, we recently did a comedy bit about how baseball lineups are getting more and more to be dominated by Dominican, Mexican, and Japanese names. Pitchers from Japan are talking with American sports writers through interpreters now.
Absolutely.
Can baseball still be called the great American pastime?
Well, I think baseball is finally coming to terms with the reality, you know, that the World Series has been a fraudulent title for well over a century. The champion of Major League Baseball is only the champion of Canada and the United States, obviously. So, you know, a real World Series, I guess the closest thing we've had is the Baseball Classic summer ago. And, of course, the United States fell out of that one pretty early on.
Right. That was too bad. Bill, do you have a favorite play, single baseball play, that you've ever witnessed in a baseball game? Is there a play that stands out from all your years of baseball game going?
I love infield play. I'm a great fan of the well-executed play in the infield. A shortstop who, you know, maybe a veteran, and he doesn't have quite the speed or the range that he had 10 years ago, but he knows how to play a hitter, and he goes back a second base, takes a single away from a hitter, and, you know, turns and pivots and throws to first and gets a guy out. I think that's it's a dancer's play. It's a magical kind of moment. And, of course, more powerful to me because it's not a triple play. It's a routine play. But
that's right.
Routine? My goodness. Think of all the skills that go into the composition of that particular routine.
And in the few seconds that it takes a runner to get to first, all that has happened.
Absolutely.
Have you ever seen a triple play actually executed?
I don't think I've seen a triple play in person. I've seen them watching games on television. But, of course, they say part of the charm of baseball is, even though it's been going on for so long, every game gives you an opportunity to see something that you've never seen before.
Well, that brings me to the subject of the infield fly rule. I know it's important, and I know it preserves the game from chicanery on the part of infielders.
Or at least some chicanery.
Some chicanery. But does the ball know that it's out when it's up there in the air and the umpire declares that it's out?
Well, I suppose given the variety of performance-enhancing and other drugs that have turned up in baseball, you could probably find players who say the ball knows exactly what's going on at all times. But I'm not prepared to answer that question with with any certainty.
Well, talking about taboo substances, what about this controversy raging in the papers now? Will it simmer down? Or will it destroy baseball's popularity?
Oh, I think it's bound to simmer down, and I think that, eventually cooler heads will prevail, and the sense will be, since we're never going to know the actual extent to which players cheated, how many, and how they did it exactly, the best thing to do is move on.
Now I have to ask you, and remember you're under oath and this is public radio, do you yourself use any performance-enhancing substances to make yourself into such a great baseball commentator?
Well, I really appreciate the nature of the question and the assumption behind the question. That's very flattering, and I thank you for that. I'm gonna answer the question by saying I did a panel one time with a friend of mine, Lee Montville, who's a wonderful sports writer, has recently written a great biography of Babe Ruth. And somebody was asking us about that, and I hemmed and hawed. I said, gee whiz, I don't know whether I would take a performance-enhancing substance if I knew there was one that would make me a better writer or a better radio reporter or commentator. And Lee Montville said, as for me, if somebody came up to me and said, here's the Hemingway pill, and it'll take 10 years off your life, but you'll write like Hemingway for as long as you live, I'd take it in a minute. Now, Hemingway's not my favorite writer, so I wouldn't be tempted by that particular one. But if somebody said, you know, here's the Faulkner pill or here's the Robert Penn Warren pill, I'd have to give it some thought.
Oh, boy. So a bottle of Jack Daniels next to you at your radio
You know,
station.
That worked for them. I'm not sure it would work for me.
I wonder, now that I think back on Mel Allen's excitable nature as Joe DiMaggio put one out of Yankee Stadium, I wonder, was he on something? Because that very phrase, going, going, gone, sounds like somebody in the throes of something juiced.
I think Mel Allen was merely operating on the strength of his own authentic enthusiasm. And
right.
I think that that's probably true of most of the guys who have had the job that Mel Allen has had, whether with the Yankees or somebody else. Most of those guys, at least the fellas that I've met, have considered themselves absolutely fortunate, just lucky to be in the presence of baseball every day, every working day, and that is enough to sustain the enthusiasm.
Right. Well, I thank you, Bill, for joining us today on this baseball special edition of Selected Shorts, and I hope to see you again soon, perhaps at a World Series between teams from our respective cities or
that would
playoff.
Be great fun. The last time it happened, it was heartbreaking, but who's to know that it would turn out the same way the next time.
All the best.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game and author of the new book, Only a Game. We'd like to wind up our special baseball program with the actor Fritz Weaver's memorable reading at Symphony Space of a poem by the noted American poet Ralph Humphreys, in which the lengthening shadows creep gradually from the plate to the mound to second base and on into the outfield as the longtime fan watches the afternoons and the days and the years go by, with each new generation of the boys of summer remaining forever young. If you listen closely, you'll hear the poet Ralph Humphreys include his own father among the lists of the old-time players. The poem is named for the quaint old ballpark where the New York Giants played before they decamped for San Francisco, the Polo Grounds. The reader is the terrific actor, and I mean serious baseball fan, Fritz Weaver. Ralph Humphreys, Polo Grounds.
Time is of the essence. This is a highly skilled and beautiful mystery. 3 or 4 seconds only. From the time that Riggs connects till he reaches first. And in those seconds, Jurgis goes to his right, comes up with the ball, tosses to Wittick at second for the force on Reese, Wittick to Mize at first, in time for the double play. Double play. Red Barber crescendo. Crowd noises obbligato. Scattered staccatos from the Peanut Boys, loud in the lull as the teams are changing sides. Hubble takes the sign, nods, pumps, delivers a foul into the stands. Dunn takes out a new ball, hands it to Danning, who throws it down to Werber. Werber takes off his glove, rubs the ball briefly, tosses it over to Hub, who goes to the rosin bag, takes the sign from Danning, pumps, delivers low, outside, ball three. Danning goes out to the mound, says something to Hub. Dunn brushes off the plate. Adams starts throwing in the giant bullpen. Hub takes the sign from Danning. He pumps. He delivers. Camilli gets hold of it. A long fly way out. Ott goes back against the wall, gets under it, pounds his glove, and takes it for the out. That's all for the Dodgers. Time is of the essence. The rhythms break. More varied and subtle than any kind of dance, movement speeds up or lags. The ball goes out in sharp, angular drives or in long, slow arcs. Comes in again controlled and under aim. The players wheel or spurt, race, stoop, slide, halt, shift imperceptibly into new positions, watching the signs according to the batter, the score, the inning. Time is of the essence. Time is of the essence. Remember Terry? Remember Stonewall Jackson, Lindstrom, Frisch, when they were good? You remember Long George Kelly? Remember John McGraw, Benny Koff? Remember Bridwell, Tenney, Merkel, Youngs, Chief Myers, Big Jeff Tesro, Shufflin' Phil? Remember Mathewson and Ames and Donlin, Buck Ewing, Roozy, Smiling Mickey Welch? Remember a left-handed catcher named Jack Humphreys, who sometimes played in the outfield in 83? Time is of the essence. The shadow moves from the plate to the box to second base, from second to the outfield, from the outfield to the bleachers. Time is of the essence. The crowd and the players are the same age, always. But the man in the crowd is older every season. Come on, play ball.
Fritz Weaver reading the poem Polo Grounds by Rolf Humphreys. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Rob Christensen. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2007 by Stephen King, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is given by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the Lila Atchison Wallace Theater Fund in the New York Community Trust, the Henry Nias Foundation, the Axe Houghton Foundation, the Arthur Foundation, and members of the Symphony Space Literature Producers Circle. Public funds come from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art, and the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC New York Public Radio and distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.